Hello and welcome to the Food and Drink Show with myself, Karen Morton, and Paul Couchman. Now, you'll hear from Paul a little later on in the show when we join him for some cooking in the kitchen. The Food and Drink Show is produced in Brighton, East Sussex, England, so you will hear a bias towards food producers locally, but of course many provide a mail order service too, so a global reach is of course possible. Food themes are for everyone, and we invite you to join the conversation beyond the studio by connecting with us on Facebook and on Instagram at Tasty Radio Brighton. The Food and Drink Show is produced for Radio Reverb and is available on podcast by looking up The Food and Drink Show. And if you want, add extra ease to the search, throw in my name as well, Karen Morton. The Food and Drink Show is sponsored by Brighton Gin, which is made lovingly by hand beside the sea. And if you go to the website of Brighton Gin, you will find two strengths, Pavilion Strength and Seaside Strength. Core does that pack a punch. Both delightfully refreshing. Here is a drink to write down now. I found myself drinking a pretty average Prosecco recently, and I needed some oomph. So what did I think of doing at the time? I messaged Kathy Caton, founder of Brighton Gin, and I explained my dilemma. The solution? Well, here you go. She said, Karen, turn it into a French 75 with her magic wand. And that's exactly what I did. And what you add into that is some Brighton Gin, a twist of lemon juice, a spoon of sugar, add it into your Prosecco, stir it up, et voila, superbe. You get more cocktail advice, ideas and all sorts of deliciousness if you go to the Brighton Gin website, and that's www.brightongin.com. Now, today's show is bursting with zesty conversation about the humble orange. What's not to like about this incredible fruit that's not only, you know, crammed packed with vitamin C and fibre, but adds both flavour to sweet and savoury dishes, as well as being enjoyed in the hand, peeling back its textured skin to break free segments of juicy flesh to refresh us in the moment. At this time of year, Seville oranges have been taking prominent display, and why not? It's marmalade making season. We'll join Paul to get through the methods of making the perfect pot, so do have that pen and paper handy. Seville oranges are the recommended variety for making marmalade, but other varieties are better for eating and juicing. Staying in Spain, I want to take you to what is known as the Orchard of Spain, Valencia. And we're going to meet a farming community who collaborate together under the banner Crowd Farming. We are going to learn more about what they do from Isabel Diaz.
Crowd farming, the idea itself started in Valencia, in a farm that's owned still by Gonzalo and Gabriel Urculo. It was an orange farm from their grandparents. That was passed on to them, and they had those orange trees that were not really in production, so they decided to take over the farm, put them in production again, and they realized the lack of transparency that was in the food supply chain, because, you know, they went and sold their oranges at a price that was set by somebody else, not by them. Which was much lower than the price that they needed to keep the farm going, especially because they wanted to farm organically with no pesticides, herbicides, and that does require more work, more people working on the farm, and so they couldn't do it that way, or they couldn't work like they wanted to in with the traditional food supply chain. So they had the idea of, why don't we put the trees up for adoption? So somebody can have this tree, and they can name it after whatever they want to name the tree, and they can receive their harvest at home from the tree. That way, as a farmer, you already know what you're going to sell. You get direct feedback from the consumer. You know exactly where it's going, and you have your harvest pretty much planned for the whole season. You know you're going to get it. You're going to sell it. You're going to sell it for a fair price. And for the side of the consumer, what they get, which we call crowd farmers, they get a product directly from the farm to the house without this intermediate storage and this extra transportation that food goes through to get to the supermarket. So you get a much more fresh product directly from the farmer. You know exactly where it comes from, how it was produced, and you get it right at your doorstep. So from that idea of crowd farming, they created crowdfarming.com because many other neighboring farmers and other farmers started messaging them, asking, you know, how they could also get involved in this. So that's when they created the website and the start of crowdfarming.com. And that's when a lot of, you know, it was first mostly us reaching out to farmers, asking if they wanted to join. Also farmers that knew Gonzalo and his brother personally wanted to join. And now it's most farmers want to join because they realize the benefit that there is, not just for them, but also for the consumer.
Because it's so exciting. And it just so happened that Paul, my fellow presenter, and I, and he happened to say, right, it's coming up now to marmalade making time. And of course, we think of the lovely Seville oranges and lots of pips and pulp and everything to make good marmalade. And I went off to the farm shop and I got my oranges, and I happened to read an article that was saying, you know, by a chef, that if you're making marmalade, that there is a difference between organic oranges in that you get much more flavor, and also that you get it you need less sugar because it actually gels easier and better. So I was quite fascinated when I started going into it, and I found yourselves and I thought, this is such a wonderful idea. Now tell me, because I like that whole thing about being connected to your food source. So say I was to adopt a tree. How many oranges would I get from that tree?
Right. So you have to reserve a minimum quantity. So when you adopt a tree, for most farmers, the minimum quantity is 3 boxes. And usually those 3 boxes also depends on the farmer, but they could be 5 kilos or 10 kilos each. And you can plant it throughout the season. For example, the orange season goes from December until April. So from December to April, you can plan your harvest, and you can receive them whenever you want. During the planning process, you can choose a delivery date. There's a calendar that pops down, and you can choose a date, because also one of our philosophy is to be as green as possible. So we want the trucks to leave completely full. So we have selected several dates during the month where we know that we're going to collect a large enough number of orders, so the truck leaves completely full, and we optimize transport as much as possible. So yeah, usually you reserve a minimum quantity of 3, but you can add more boxes to your adoption if you want. Many crowd farmers, they also like to share with family members or with friends, or in their community, they share amongst you know, neighbors. It's very exciting to see how some crowd farmers, like, they spread the word by sharing their orders. So yeah, and you're always welcome. Of course, right now it's a little more complicated, of course, to travel, but you're always welcome to visit the farms. All farmers in their platform accept visits. You just have to message us with a time and date that you want to go. And if you have an adoption, you can go visit your adoption, go visit your tree. You name the tree, and you and the farmer will hang a name, the plaque that gets hanged on the tree, and it stays there until you renew it every year. So every year you're asked if you want to renew your adoption.
I just love that. I mean, I have a special birthday coming up this year. And what could be nicer than having a beautiful orange tree in my name?
They're a great gift.
Isn't that such a good thing? And what I also love is that when you go on the website, you get to see the various farmers. And it's a bit like some of the, you know, the vine growers with wine. You get to meet the farmer, you get to see where they are, the family. They tell you a little bit about themselves and their trees, and I think it's just so lovely. And to think, and I love the whole idea about being a crowd farmer, so I too become a farmer, really, that association with the tree. Now, what's the cost to this? So if I want to you know, put my name to a tree, what's the minimum, or how does that work?
The cost is also depends on the farmer. It's not a set cost for all farmers because they set the price. So what we also wanted to make different is that the farmer knows best what his or her product is worth, because they're the ones that are there every day, not a supermarket or a big company that comes and tells them what they think their product is worth. So they set the price, and then the first payment for the adoption is the maintenance cost and the food itself. And then when you plan your harvest, you pay for the logistical costs. And that logistical cost also, what it includes is not only the shipping costs, but also the costs behind crowd farming as a company, which is everyone that works at crowd farming. We offer service in 4 different languages, in English, Spanish, French, and German. So we offer the customer service in all those languages, so every crowd farmer can feel, you know, come if there's any incident with the delivery or anything, or any questions, they can come to us pretty much in those 4 languages, and we can assist them. We have a logistics department that helps a farmer prepare their orders, because for most farmers, shipping directly to the consumer is new to them. So they need help logistically to prepare the boxes, ship the boxes. So we provide that support for them. Of course, also the marketing, because of them alone, they don't have the, you know, the resources to market their product, to really reach all these countries that inside Europe that we reach. So we also offer them marketing support so they can sell their product to all countries in Europe, pretty much.
And it's great, because even if you go on, and I'm in England and I went on and it was initially in Spanish, but of course it transcribed very quickly, and I got an email back very quickly as well from you. And the whole thing, you know, just worked out fantastic. But I was really blown away by it. And this whole idea about the organic oranges. Now, what is it about oranges from Spain? You know, why is it that we kind of put it up there, you know, sort of like the champagne of France or whatever? You know, there must be something scientific. What is that, Isabella?
I think it must be a combination of just the weather that we have in Spain is pretty much perfect for the cultivation of any fruit, or most fruit, even tropical fruits. Mangoes and avocados from Spain are absolutely amazing. We also have those in the platform. And, you know, sometimes people associate tropical fruits or citrus fruits to more tropical places in the world. Mm. But in Spain, in Europe, we have those products as well. Oranges in particular, I remember I was talking to this Instagrammer that we collaborate with. She's from the UK. She was telling me how in her childhood she always heard oranges from Valencia, and it's just, I think also pop culture probably popularized them as the best oranges that you can get in Europe, as well as Seville oranges, which I know are very popular in the UK to make marmalade. And it's just, I mean, once you try them, especially, and it makes such a huge difference when they're directly from the farmer, that they get to your house in just a week, the taste is just much more intensified, because they haven't been in in refrigerated storage, which we know that the refrigeration takes away a lot of the flavor from the fruit. And with oranges that are sent directly from the farm to your door, you don't lose that flavor, so you really get the most out of the oranges. Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, organic oranges are better to make marmalade, and a lot of customers actually, the reason why they even want to get oranges that are organic and from us, it's because they can use the peel of the orange, because you might have probably seen it, but the oranges that we see mostly in supermarkets, they shine pretty much, and that's because that's wax. I mean, that's not natural. Fruit is not supposed to shine. It can be beautiful, of course, and everything, but it's not supposed to shine. Like, if it's perfect, it's not natural. That's why we always say, because perfection, nature is already perfect. Even if it's an ugly fruit, it doesn't affect the taste inside. And yeah, we don't apply any products to the skin of the orange, which therefore you can use to cook, to make sweets, marmalades, everything. So that's a big one too.
So, you know, you're right. We say, you know, Seville oranges, marmalade. And when we're thinking about Valencia, I love Valencia, by the way, the food markets in Valencia. Oh, my word, okay. It's just incredible, and the restaurants. But what would you say, you know, from Valencia, what would the farmers say that is the best way to eat an orange from Valencia or to serve an orange from Valencia?
I really think they would just tell you to eat it like probably not juice. And there are oranges that's specific to juice. Of course, you can juice all oranges. There's an orange called Valencia Latte, and that one is specifically for juicing, and that's sort of a later season after April, which is December to April is the Navel variety. And that one is the most popular one. And I believe every farmer would just tell you to eat it, just peel it and eat it straight. That's the best way to eat the oranges probably. And of course we have, I mean, you get a box of 5 or 10 kilograms of oranges. So if you don't even want to eat all of them, you can prepare amazing recipes with the oranges that would just be much more flavorful. But yeah, I think if you were to ask the farmers, they'll tell you just straight.
Eat it as it is.
Eat it as it is, yeah.
Well,
and
my...
if you go visit, just get it from the tree and eat it.
Well, my grandmother growing up, I always remember when I would go to stay with her. I grew up in Ireland, in the south of Ireland, and then we would go and stay with her in Northern Ireland. And I would, when we were going to bed, she would put a saucer with an orange cut up, you know, into four, you know, into segments, mm-hmm. with the skin on. With the idea being that when you woke up in the morning, you just sort of sucked the orange, and that was like an orange juice, really, but it just refreshed you in the morning. And all her life, she did that. And you know what? I have been doing it now for her son, who's my dad, who's the same age as she is, an old man. But I just thought, you know what, Dad, why don't you start doing that? Because you wake up in the morning and there they are, they're ready. And you just have that, you know, and of course with the pulp and everything, you know, it's much healthier for you because you got the roughage as well. But I just thought it's such a good idea, and it's so enjoyable when you do that, you know, cutting it into quarters. And the other thing from when I was growing up, I'm not sure, Isabel, if you know of it in Spain, but as a child, what we used to do is our mothers used to scoop out the inside of an orange, okay, mix mm-hmm. it in with the jelly, and then fill the orange cups, yeah, the orange skin cut in half, with jelly, put it in the fridge, and then you served it up for parties, you know, the oranges with jellies, and then every child could scoop out, you know, and they had orange jelly. Have you done that before?
I've never heard of it. I think the thing is, in countries where the oranges are not, like for example, in the UK or Germany, people are much more creative with the product. That's actually what I've seen. They make a lot of uses out of the product, and I've never heard that before. No.
Yeah. Well, there you go. That's one now for you to try. But it looks so wonderful
for
on
sure.
a table, you know, for sharing. You're getting the juice, you're getting jellies, and you can make multicolors. But I just remember that now when talking of oranges. So I've had a lot of fun not only looking at your crowdfarming website, but just the whole, I'm experiencing oranges at the moment in a different way. And I love the fact that you were saying that, okay, you have the early season up till April, and then for the big juicers, you know, sort of go back on and just see then if you want to, you know, to order specifically particular types of oranges for juice or something else, which is just wonderful. Now, for any of our listeners who would love to know more and are curious, how do they get in touch with you at Crowdfarming?
So you can visit us at crowdfarming.com, and there you'll be able to, if you filter by your country of delivery, for example, UK, it will show all the farmers that are currently shipping to the UK. And you'll be able to find the prices. We also sell not only from the adoptions, but we also sell individual boxes if you want to try it before, let's say, committing to an adoption.
Ah.
And so you can order a single box from a farmer, and that price includes everything. The final price includes also the shipping cost. So you'll see on the website that it has two options, adopt or buy a box. Mm-hmm. And if you go and buy a box, you'll see all the farmers that are currently shipping orders. On our website, you'll also be able to find our blog, which we're currently up. We are always updating it with topics that are of interest to us, like, for example, our transport, the impact of our transport. Farmers, we call them farmer voices, and they, whatever's going on in their farm, if they want to share it with us, we do a blog post about it. So the blog is also really, really interesting to find out more about us and our concept. And we also have a YouTube channel, and of course, on our website, you'll find a lot of information. We try to be as transparent as possible. On the farmer pages, you'll see, for the organic farmers, you'll be able to download their organic certificate. For the farmers that are in conversion to organic, you'll be able to download the analysis that are done on their fruit that are pesticide free. So really, there's a lot of information there. And if there's anything else that they want to ask, they can always call us, email us on our contact form, and we'll be happy to help and assist.
Well, I'm excited. I can't wait to do more. I'm enjoying the website, and you know, I just love the fact that I can keep up to date with the blog, and of course the other, you know, products, as you said there. You know, I never thought about mangoes. You know, we just think of them coming from much further afield. So Isabella Dias, thank you for sharing with us today here on the Food and Drink Show. We look forward to tasting your oranges. I can't wait for my order to arrive now.
Absolutely. I look forward to your feedback.
It's funny, I know. Nobody sings about oranges, the reason's no rhyme. I'm starting to mind how we take our ideas, we put them in storage, we peel back the rind. Who knows what you find? Take the same risks as if you're afraid. If life gave you an orange, would you make lemonade? And it's funny, yeah, nobody sings about oranges when you got one in the palm of your hand. Crazy how nobody sings about chocolate. It seems there would be nothing so sweet like we're living in the box. If someone has locked it, how can that be? It just ain't for me. We're curving our motions and making our bets. If you don't open the chocolate, who knows what you get? And it's crazy how nobody sings about chocolate when you got it in the palm of your hand. Nobody sings about oranges. Yeah, it's funny how nobody sings about oranges. About oranges when you got one in the palm of your hand.
A song, appropriately enough, all about oranges. That came from Clyde Lawrence from his album Homesick. Hello and welcome to the Food and Drink Show. If you've just joined us, we had that fabulous interview learning more about how we can order organic oranges directly from the farms in Valencia in Spain. Well, it is now time to go across to our virtual kitchen to join Paul Couchman. Now, the thing is, please, listeners, I hope you can understand that we are recording remotely. And sometimes the internet is not always the best or the connection as clear as we would like. So this is not quite studio quality, but Paul is as gorgeous as ever and has many treats for us to enjoy. So let's go find him.
Paul, the last time we were together, the one thing you were talking about, which really inspired me, was about oranges and, of course, that time of year for making marmalade. So inspired was I that I happened to be in the farm shop just off the 281 coming into Brighton, And lo and behold, a big display of Seville oranges and jars that you could buy for making your own marmalade. So I whipped up a box of oranges and some jars, and off I went on my merry way to make marmalade. So I think this is the time where you show me yours and I'll show you mine.
I want to know, because I've done two different methods. So I've got a lovely book by, it's a woman called Pam Corbin, who worked at the River Cottage. So it's her book of preserves. She's called Pam the Jam on Twitter, which is lovely. And I've
Pam the Jam.
Pam the Jam, they're wonderful. And she's got two methods, and I'm just curious to know your method. I just say that which they are. There's the sliced fruit method or the whole fruit method.
Ooh.
Which one did you go for?
I did the slicing. I did the juicing and the slicing into tiny little slivers.
Okay.
Of peel.
So the other way that you could do it is you boil the fruit whole. So you just scrub your oranges, you put them into the pan with water, bring to the boil, simmer, and then cover for 2.5 hours until the orange skins are tender. And then you take them out, and then you add the cooking water. So, and then you make up the amount with more water. You cut your oranges in half, take out the pit, and then you start cutting up the orange peel, which is really soft at this stage because it's been boiled away.
Mm.
So it's easier to slice with this method. Then you put that back, you add the sugar, lemon juice, and then you know you boil it down again until you make the jam, really. I've rushed through that, but that's the method.
Well, so I like the idea of that, and it also means by doing it that way, because not everybody, you know, there's that whole thing about you can buy marmalades now where there's no peel in them at all. They're crystal clear. And then you have, you know, traditionally your marmalade with the bits of peel in it. So I suppose if you were wanting to make a marmalade without the peel, would that be the better method?
Yeah, possibly.
Mm.
I mean, it's got advantages. Because you know how hard it is to slice, because I did it this morning, it's quite hard to slice orange peel when it's raw. It's a lot easier when it's cooked, isn't it? But I love both methods.
So tell me what went into the recipe that you had, because really it's here in Britain that we use the oranges for making marmalade. In Spain, they would use it more in cooking and fish dishes. And also candied, you know, sort of done in sugar or dark chocolate or whatever, or making an orange marzipan. So the marmalade is something very British. How has that come about, Paul?
Well, you see, it wasn't British in the beginning.
Really?
So it starts off in Portugal. It starts off as a very expensive imported delicacy, really. So you get boxes of quince paste, and the first quince we went to that was actually the 10th of March 1495. So we got the first written record of marmalade, and called it marmalo as well, which is Portuguese for quince.
Mm.
So it was a quince paste very similar to membrillo, you know, very similar to membrillo. So they did flavour it sometimes with other spices, with cinnamon and stuff like that. So it's a very expensive elite food. And at some point, they started doing oranges in a similar way. So it's a way of cooking it down, boiling it down until it's a paste. You take out all the water, and then it's almost solid. And also, you can store it then better. So they do that with oranges. They do that with prunes, cherries, apricots as well. And all of that they call marmalade at that point. Mm-hmm. And then eventually that name changes, and you get down to the 19th century, and you get Dundee marmalade from the Keyless.
Yes. So what is the difference? I mean, when you have a Dundee, I mean, my recollection of Dundee marmalade, it's like really thick.
Mm. And they cook it. I think it's probably the whole fruit method because it's cooked right down. So it's actually quite dark, isn't it?
Yes.
And also quite solid, I remember, from the stuff I've had.
You know,
it's not that loose stuff. It's usually quite
yeah, quite no, thin. No. It also depends on the sugar that you use as well, isn't it? You know, what colour sugar, what type of sugar. And so therefore, you've got to think about the look, not just the taste of the marmalade you're going for. Now, what was your recipe, Paul?
So I did both. I did the sliced fruit and the whole fruit. The sliced fruit is probably just the same as yours, because basically you scrub the oranges, you take out the little buttons, and then you cut the oranges in half, squeeze the juice out, keep that to one side. And then with a knife, you want to slice all your peel out, and then you throw that in with the orange juice. you add water to that, and then it sits for, well, it says overnight, it can be up to 24 hours, and then it's adding, you know, it's doing the same process again. You add the lemon juice and the sugar, you bring that to a boil, 20, 25 minutes, and then, as you've probably done it, it's all that testing, isn't it, until you've got a setting point, really, until it, I put little saucers in the freezer for that, and you just pop a little bit on, and you have to push a little a dollop of marmalade across the plate, and if it wrinkles, then you know that it's reached its setting point, and that's when you can start to jar it. Is that how you do it?
And that is how I did it. Well, yeah. Maybe the earlier part just slightly different. I did the cooking all at one time, and I followed Delia Smith, actually. I mean, it was not dissimilar to many that I found online, you know, with the oranges and one lemon and then the sugar. I played around a little bit. I mixed my sugars up in there. But I it was a bit of trial and error, funnily enough, for me. I thought it had set and it hadn't, and it was too runny. So I had to boil it up again. And I think that's the thing for anyone who hasn't made marmalade before. And there's still time. There's still Seville oranges around there. A nice tart orange for making your jam. But it what I needed to do really was to have it on for longer on the boil, you know, with the sugars and that.
Yep.
So I had to kind of have another go. The other thing as well is that I sort of had, you know, sort of had boiled it up, turned it off to go off to do something else. And the other critical thing, which I didn't do, and therefore when I redid the marmalade, was that I didn't take, you know, the marmalade that was very warm and also the jars being warm at the same time. So the science, I think, really, between how you use the method, how you, you know, you boil your oranges, etc., making sure that you have your little muslin in there with the pith and the pips, because that's really where the pectin is, isn't it? And you're getting all that lovely flavor as well too for the thickening. So I found it a really, really interesting process, because I had never actually made marmalade myself. Again, I'm spoiled rotten all my life. You know, it was my mum and my aunt who made all those things, and I could smell it and see it and taste it as they were doing it, but totally on my own. So that was good. And I was very pleased with the result. And of course, the wonderful thing is that you get, because of the, I mean, where I was using the Seville orange, but it's just lovely, because even though you're using the sugar, you've still got that little bit of tartness, really, haven't you? You know what I mean, in there. And even to smell, I've got one of the oranges here, and when you smell it, there is it's so wonderful. It's so refreshing, isn't it? It really is. I could just get a high from sniffing it. Did you use the Seville oranges?
Yeah, absolutely. We just bought what there was in the shop, because they weren't coming in for a while, and then suddenly they were there. And so we bought all we could. So I've actually got loads. So that's why I've done six jars, seven jars of one and seven jars of another. So that's loads. That's enough for the year, really, isn't it?
It's great. And, you know, really, it's amazing how quickly a jar of marmalade can go down, you know, if you're using it. And I don't know about you, but of course it's there as well too for cooking with.
Yes.
And you can make your syrups, and even what is lovely with these oranges is that, you know, why not slice them up, put them in the freezer, and then pop them into your drinks or your sauces that making. So, you know, I turned actually to our book that we both love using, the Flavors Thesaurus. And there's some lovely combinations of using orange and actually using it in the cooking, you know, in your bouquet garni with beef. And of course, we all love, you know, orange and carrot soup and things like that. So these sort of tartar oranges like the Seville, just so good, really, for cooking, isn't it? So good for cooking.
I'm trying to reach across my table now, because I've got an old recipe, actually, which you'll probably like. I just have to grab it now as well. So this is, it comes from How to Cook the Victorian Way, from Annie Gray. I was chatting to her on Twitter, and she was saying the best recipe in this book, she had a load of cooks made all the historic recipes up, and there is a recipe for marmalade, but there's also actually something called an amber cake, if I can find it just quickly. And it is, here we go, amber pudding. So let me just read out what's in it. It's got marmalade, suet, breadcrumbs, eggs, and it's served with a wine sauce. So all those ingredients go together in a pudding cloth, and then you cook them for probably about 3 hours, 3.5 hours in, you know, they get steamed, basically. And it's a steamed pudding. And the chefs who cooked it said it was absolutely delicious. It's just that combination of things together. And it is, on the photograph here, it's a lovely sort of orangey colour as well. And I love the name, Amber Pudding.
Isn't that gorgeous?
Yeah, and so that's the next one to try.
Sounds wonderful. And yes, of course, the colour orange as well. I mean, yes, everybody loves the colour orange. It is actually festive. It makes us feel good. It's a harmony colour. And so having it in decor around us when we're eating or as we eat, there's just something so enticing, isn't there, about the orange. I want to give a shout out now, Paul, just while we're on about oranges, to The Real Patisserie, because they have the most amazing orange and Earl Grey meringue tart or pie. It is the most wonderful alternative to a lemon meringue pie. My brother introduced it to me a week ago, and it was so good that I walked all the way into Brighton to, you know, Western Road, bypassing the one in Hove, because they'd been sold out. So clearly the word is getting around. Absolutely delicious. Have you made that yourself?
Do you know what, though? Because we're talking about, I've still got lots of Seville oranges, and I love lemon meringue pie. Mm. And of course, you can just replace the lemon with Seville oranges. And that'd be incredible. So I can make that. And we've got lots of eggs left over.
Yeah.
So there you go. You've given me a fantastic idea.
And try it with the little hint of Earl Grey. I do think that there's something subtle in there, but you can imagine it's the perfume, I think, as well, too, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's kind of got that lovely fruity herbiness about it. So that was really a big surprise. And another shout out I'd like to make is to a wonderful company. And we're going to have this company featured next month. And we're all about chocolate as we're coming up to Easter. And it's the Brighton Cacao Company. And they've just opened up on Portland Road in Hove. But of course, God love them, we went into lockdown. So George has had to continue doing things in a wholesale fashion. But when he reopens, he'll be serving hot chocolate, and you can buy your chocolates he's making on the premises. But I got in there, and I was able to pick up some chocolates. But one of the chocolate bars that he has, that you'll see in some of the shops in around Hove, and actually some of the bakeries are selling his chocolate. And there's one which is a milk chocolate, orange and lime. And it's a very attractive sort of orangey leafy wrapper. So, and what is lovely too, is that the chocolate, if you can hear, is wrapped in paper. So it feels like a gift whenever you slip the beautifully decorated outer covering. And what I did as well is I bought a Terry's chocolate orange. I mean, what is it that people love about chocolate and orange together?
Yeah.
Is it a favourite of yours, that combination?
Of course. And I love chocolate oranges. We've only recently been buying them from the newsagents. That's a coincidence, isn't it? Yeah.
Isn't it?
Cheerful. It's quite cheerful, isn't it?
So cheerful. Well, of course, what Terry's was very clever about is the beautiful shape. It feels like a gift. It feels like an orange. And you've all those segments and easy to share. And you're really getting that orange oil flavour coming out. But did you know that Terry's Chocolate Orange originally started as Terry's Chocolate Apple?
I didn't know that. How lovely. The apple obviously didn't work.
Well, it was popular at the time, and they introduced the orange as another flavour. And after the war years, it just became more popular, and they stopped it. So then, and again, this is in our wonderful book, The Flavours Book. So it originally was the apple, launched in 1926. The apple proved so popular that an orange version was launched 4 years later. When both went back into production after the war, orange quickly overtook apple in popularity, and the latter was discontinued in 1954. The chocolate orange finally grew up in 1975 when the dark chocolate version was introduced. Its bitter astringency complementing the sweet muskiness of the orange oil. What is your favourite, the dark chocolate or the milk chocolate?
I didn't even know there were two sorts.
No, I didn't either.
I don't know. The one that we get, I think it's I think it is slightly bitter, so it should be plain chocolate as well then.
Well, I've got the orange one. I've been nibbling my way through because you have to for research. So what I did was I was comparing Terry's chocolate orange, which looks like an orange and it has the orange segments in it, beautifully decorated. And I let it melt in my mouth. And then I kind of went away and I came back and I took a square off the Brighton, the Cacao Company one. And I had a little nibble on that and I let it melt in my mouth. So the difference, I would say, well, it's more expensive. But if you enjoy Terry's chocolate orange, gorgeous. You know, both I tried both the milk chocolate versions. What I would say about the Brighton Cacao Company is that it's smoother on the tongue from a chocolate point of view. And the orange oil in there as the flavouring is more subtle. So I do enjoy it. Okay, so I'm not knocking the Terry's chocolate orange, but I must say I did enjoy it now, and both are milk chocolate. So it's just if you want to support local, handmade on the premises on Portland Road, and you can order online from Brighton Cacao Company, and we'll be having a chat with George coming up, talking about all sorts of things to do with chocolate and patisserie. So very good. So keep an eye out for that. And I hope, isn't that gas that you've also just recently bought a chocolate orange as well? Amazing, amazing. So what else have you been doing with oranges?
The other thing I was doing, I've been doing this constantly. So what I do is collect all my orange peels and I candy the peels when I've got enough in my freezer because I get them all out and candy them.
Wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people don't do that and it's really easy because basically you just, well, it's very similar to marmalade. It's the question of cooking the peel down into it's really soft. And you do the same stages, but instead of making a liquid, you're making it solid. So it's a bit tricky towards the end because you've basically got to get all the sugar out, all the water out, actually. So you candy it down to a really, really thick syrup. And then you take out the pieces from that syrup. And you can keep the syrup as well because it's got a lovely orange flavour. And you dry those out on a cake rack or something. And then I dust them as well when they're dry with a bit more sugar and you pop them into tins. And they keep really well, and it's great for any baking that you want to do. And it's just so much better than normal candied fruit. You can buy really expensive candied fruit that tastes similar, but it's just so much easier to do yourself. It's really lovely. And your kitchen, you know, like you said, when you're making the marmalade, your kitchen smells absolutely
so beautiful. Wonderful.
Yeah. Mm. Why wouldn't you want to do that at home? It's a lovely thing to do.
Well, I can imagine there now, and I think I'll have a go at that candied. And I like it too when you do it with a dip of dark chocolate at one end. You know, you could buy that at Christmas. But to make it yourself, and of course, you're using up your whole orange then, aren't you? You know, you can have the juice. But I'll tell you what I did do, which will make you laugh, with the Seville oranges. I thought, you know, I'll taste it raw, you know. So anyway, I peeled myself a little bit of a chunk off there. Oh, my Lord. It was, it is definitely for cooking with, do you know what I mean? Or squeezing into, you know, maybe mixing it in with your cocktails or your syrups or whatever. So it's very bitter. And of course, you've all those pips in there.
Oh, the pips, yeah.
But anyway, it made me laugh. And I really understood then, you know, the difference in the oranges, do you know what I mean? Rather than the very sweet ones that we buy for juicing, etc.
The Seville oranges, those were the original oranges that people used to eat right up until the Chinese oranges took over. So all oranges were bitter for a long, long period of our history. And it wasn't until later that we got the Chinese oranges, which are sweeter. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it?
Now, if you want to try a wine that is orange, believe it or not, I went into, there's a new wine shop that has opened up, and it's just at the end of Shirley Drive and the parade of shops there. And it caught my eye because I know that part of the world, and it's called Nine Vines. So it's at Woodland Parade. Lovely chap, Mark. Again, he's going to come on and be a guest and talk wines with us. He has an exceptional array of wines, but I was telling him about us playing around with oranges and making marmalade. And he said, oh, have you tried this wine, a Solera? And it's actually, it's an orange natural wine. That's not made with oranges, Paul, but it's the way in which the grapes are picked and fermented, and it's leaving, you know, the skins on, the pips in it. and it does have an orange colour. So it is a white wine, but it's an orange wine. They have a lovely sunny orange on the front cover of the label, and it's called an orange natural wine, produced in, would you believe, Romania. And it's a chap originally from England, from the Bristol region. He met and married a lovely Romanian lass. They went out and they've set up this vineyard. So it's about £10 a bottle. Now, what I would say about it is it would be a white wine that if you didn't like red wine and you were having sort of a beef or a meat, you know, casserole, or a comforting, you know, shepherd's pie or something like that, it would be very good with that. But to drink it on its own, I don't know that I would class it as, you know, really a wine for an aperitif, or if you were having fish. I don't think that combination is right. But certainly if you were having a meatier, heartier dish, it would actually pair very well. But it was just interesting. I thought to try it, you know, because we were onto this orange theme. Okay, so that was my few little orangey bits there, and a few local producers. So very good. Now, Paul, what other delights have you been sampling in your kitchen?
Well, we're talking about citrus, aren't we? And we try dried limes. So I came across a recipe for Iranian food, which I've never tried before, and it's lamb shanks, which are cooked with these dried limes. I'm just going to look up the recipe now, actually. But they smell. We ordered them at a catering company. But the dried limes, I've never had before. Have you ever had them?
Dried limes? Never. I'm listening agog with this.
So this is the way to cook them. So it's a Persian spice lamb shanks. And so it's got cinnamon. It's got a whole range of spices in it. So it's very, very fragrant, actually. So you've got cinnamon, nutmeg, cardamom. There's turmeric in there, there's black pepper, there's a tiny bit of saffron. You've got the limes. And these dried limes, what you do is you pierce them and then you put them in and they absorb the flavours. So you would take your lamb shanks and you brown them off. And then you put them in with some broth and some water and all these beautiful herbs. And there's a two-stage process. So the green herbs go in for the second stage, which is a very long, slow cooking in the oven in the liquid. You see the lamb gets really soft, and it's basically then garnished with parsley, with dill, you know, with those sort of things. There's some bay leaves, there's some thyme in there as well. I mean, there's a whole load of stuff. But what the dried limes particularly do, there's a sort of aroma that they produce, and a very richness to the sauce as well. Yeah, maybe you could use Seville oranges instead, but it was absolutely delicious. I've never eaten something so wonderful. So I'm going to make that again. It really is lovely.
You're making my mouth water. You're making my mouth water. And probably the Solera wine would actually go very well. Yeah, having a glass of that with your lamb shanks sounds wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. You are listening to the Food and Drink Show on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM. And you can listen to us online and DAB. And don't forget, we also have the show that comes out a little bit later as a podcast. And you can get that from all your good podcast sources as well. Now, if you would like to get in touch with us, you can always email Radio Reverb and we will get those emails. And you can reach us at Tasty Radio Brighton on Instagram and Facebook. And if you would like to join Paul Couchman, the Regency cook, and get up to date with his lovely tweetable recipes that come out daily, Paul, give us your Twitter handle.
That's really easy. It's The Regency Cook. So I'm The Regency Cook on Twitter, on Instagram, www.paulcouchman.co.uk.
Fantastic. So if you want to try some of these simple recipes that Paul is trying, then why not join in the fun and answer the questions from Twitter. It's a nice social thing to be able to do, isn't it, Paul? And of course, the Food and Drink Show is sponsored by Brighton Gin, certainly one of my favourite gins that I love to drink. And when you have Pavilion Strength Gin, what goes into the gin but a lovely slice of orange?
Pure premium.
Hey,
Now, you have been tweeting little quickie, you know, recipes, you know, that would fit into your 140 characters. So what have you been trying and tweeting, Paul?
Let me just have a quick look. Okay. Because I basically do them every day, and they're very popular as well. We had, I think they're like little poems. So there's, oh, you see this, and this is Sussex, so this is actually from the from here. There's a lovely book called Food of England, and this is very simple. So it's called Apple Cracknell, and it's Sussex. It's sliced apples with brown sugar, topped with a crumble flour, rolled oats, butter, sugar, and ginger, and baked. And that's the recipe. But it's basically a sort of apple crumble, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Delicious.
Yes, that's so lovely, with the ginger as well.
Love it with the ginger, absolutely, yeah. Gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous. So, yes, our apples and oranges, our limes in there. And this is the great thing, isn't it, how versatile fruit is, that we can have it as savoury, cook it into sweet pies, and as you said, candy it or just eat it peeled and made into sort of lovely little mouthfuls of sweets. So all very yummy.
So I've got another one for you. This is lovely. This is baked prunes. Prunes are perfectly delicious, baked all night in the still warm oven of a stove that has been heated all day. Flavour with cloves, stick of cinnamon, sugar to taste, and half a teacup of water. The peel of half a lemon over the prunes is an improvement.
Wow. Okay, sounds great. Yeah. So you've been tweeting the tweetable recipes now, and as you said, they've been proving very popular. Which ones have really been tickling the taste buds?
This is going to really amuse you, actually. This is a slight aside, but I tweeted a picture of some fig rolls. Do you share a passion for fig rolls? Love or hate? Please let me know. And I had 61 comments, and people talk about, they're apparently very popular. People just talking about fig. Do you like fig rolls?
I love fig rolls. And funnily enough, in Ireland, whenever I was growing up, I mean, every house, you would have always had fig rolls. Yeah. You know, they were very popular. And actually, I didn't see them here for a long time when I was here in the UK. But I love them as a biscuit.
They're called Fig Newtons in America as well. And people will go on and they say, look, they were my nana's favourite. I don't know if I've had them since. People just went off and talked. People said, oh, I'm going rushing off to buy them now. So you had 96 people, you know, explaining their love for fig rolls. It was really lovely. I mean, a few people hated them, of course.
Well, you've heard, I mean, what that's all about is it's bringing that whole piece about, you know, nostalgia. And that's what food is so great for, isn't it? It bonds us, really. Yeah. And, you know, when we look at the increase in the purchasing of cookbooks and people in the kitchen and people in the garden growing, you know, and it's very soothing and comforting. And looking back at what your grandmother did or you had as a child is a wonderful thing. And those flavours just come back through visualization. And I wonder now, those people that raced off to buy them, were they as good? Because I wonder, is the recipe in the standard, you know, packet that we would have been familiar with buying still the same? Maybe that's what we need to do, is go out and get some fig rolls. So I'm going to ask you now, as a fig roll eater, did you kind of nibble off the rounded sides of the biscuit, you know, and sort of savour that before you kind of got into the figgy bit?
Yeah, this is taking me back. Yeah, you can do that. You can bite it and take it off and still have the filling sort of in a hole. Mm-hmm. Yes, I remember doing that. Yeah. There's lots of different ways of eating them, weren't there?
Oh, yes. And of course, that's the other joy whenever you kind of have a two-in-one in a biscuit, a cake, or even a fruit, an orange. You know, we eat the flesh and we can eat the skin. You are listening to The Food and Drink Show with myself, Karen Morton, and the Regency cook, Paul Couchman. Now, Paul, we're going to go and sort of link back in with him, because he's in the kitchen. He's been experimenting with hot cross buns. Let's find out a little bit more.
So it's the fourth batch now that I've cooked, and we're having to eat them all as well, which is terrible, isn't it? I'm trying to perfect my crosses at the moment on the top, because that's the hardest bit, but I'm also increasing the spicing. So I've got this wonderful original recipe that I'm playing with, but I really like, and I think lots of people like, really spicy hot cross buns, and I'm making them quite fluffy as well. So I've gone through four different variations, and I think I'm almost there now. But the final bit is the cross on the top, because that's quite tricky. You have to mix flour and water together in the right ratio to be able to get it through a piping bag, and to be able to get it to stick on top of the buns when they're risen. So it's a bit of trial and error at the moment. I think we're almost there. But I will be doing a course in April to make hot cross bun. So that'll be an 1830s version. And that's the beginning of April. I think I'm actually doing it on the Thursday and on Good Friday as well. So the Thursday before Good Friday and Good Friday. And you can cook along with me and make some delicious hot cross buns.
Well, they're just about one of the most favourite things. I think everybody loves a hot cross bun. And when they're just freshly baked and slightly warm, and even then, you know, a few days later, if they're going a bit stale, you can pop them in the toaster and they're equally delicious. They're so good. So, Paul, as always, delightful to talk with you and to hear some of your recipes as well. And I hope, listeners, we've inspired you that if you've not yet had a go at making marmalade, honestly, it really is very easy steps. And you've got some recipes. There are still the Seville oranges out there in the shops. And we'd love to know, maybe post us some of your photographs and your comments about your marmalade that you have made at home. You have been listening to The Food and Drink Show with myself, Karen Morton, and Paul Couchman, sponsored by Bright & Gin here on Radio Reverb. Thank you for listening.
Oranges and lemons. Mary and Sheila, our two tall arches, are in position, so off we go and let's see who gets caught first.
Oranges and lemons.